when Jesus wore, oh, when he wore, when Jesus wore, he washed my sins away. Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how fats from fish and vegetables can increase your lifespan, how beetroot can help lengthen your workout, how rosehip powder can improve your joint and inflammation, reduce it, how fast food fever, what we're into America, our modern diets, are impacting our immune system, and a lot more on health and healing. And then we're going to take a look at how schools are punishing factories, the handcuffing of public education, by Professor Henry Drew of Truthout. The point of no return, climate change nightmares are already here, and why we have to pay attention to them so we know what to do, by Eric Holthus from Rolling Stone. Also today, The Oligarch's Election, by Patrick Martin. My guest in the second part of our program will be John Michael Greer, one of America's most insightful historical philosophers, a futurist, independent scholar, environmentalist, and we're going to talk in our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the failure of the religion of progress, where every time you look, someone's saying, well, we'll grow, and we're saying, we shouldn't. We should be reorganizing our lives based upon the resources we have, living in balance with our resources, not exploiting everything. Also today, if time permits, I'm going to follow up on something our guest from yesterday, Gerald Chalante, said. He sees a major economic correction. Professor Michael Hudson, Greg Palast, others see a major economic correction. This morning, Michael Snyder, of his economic blog, found eight of the world's leading financial experts that are warning that a great financial crisis is imminent. So where will there be a financial collapse in the United States before, as Gerald said, before January, just 6 months away? An increasing number of respected financial experts are now warning that we're right on the verge of another great economic crisis. Now, of course, that does not guarantee that it's going to happen. Let's hope it does not happen. Experts have been wrong before. But without a doubt, red flags are popping up all over the place, and things are lining up in textbook fashion for a new financial crisis. So let's take a look at this and see what the experts have to say. Most, I'm sure, people in this audience are not familiar with. We'll deal with that. Let's begin. Oh, and by the way, also we have a lot of people in this audience who are just coming into consciousness about social issues, interpersonal corrections, healthy living. And so I'm going to be sharing with you the artist Prince EA on Sorry. Then we're going to look at a psychologist from Harvard, who's going to give us a perspective on what we eat. It's an extremely articulate and insightful presentation. So we'll have those as well. We know that we have to have fats and healthy fats in the diet. The wrong fats, like from meat and dairy, create what is called arachidonic acid. That is a pro-inflammatory fat. That's why historically people who've eaten a protein, animal protein-rich diet and fats, suffer from purines and gout. In fact, at one time, the aristocracy prided itself on being able to afford meat, and they ate meat in abundance, huge amounts. They would gorge. In some places, they actually had a place where you could go and vomit, come back and continue gorging. Long meals, taking hours. They would drink wine. That's not good. That's your purines. And then they would have the meat, more purines, and then they'd have inflammation. So good fats are necessary. And more, we're looking at how good fats impact our heart. This is from the Karolinska Institute, as well as the Uppsala University in Sweden. It is published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation. And in this study, they included 4,000 Swedish men and women who were over 60. And they showed that high levels of polyunsaturated fats in the blood are linked to a longer life, decreased risk of cardiovascular disease. In most studies that investigate the correlation between food and longevity, the people report what they have eaten, but this may be inaccurate. In the current study, the level of polyunsaturated fats in the blood of the subjects was actually measured, and this was previously shown to be a good indicator of the intake of these fats that are abundant in oily fish like salmon and herring, but also in walnuts, avocado, and olives. Quote, "This is the world's largest study ever in the area, as so far as we know, and one of its strengths is both that men and women were evaluated at the same time." This is according to the professor of the Department of Medicine at Solna Karolinska Institute. Now, the results show that high levels of these good fats in the blood are associated with decreased overall death in both men and women. In fact, in women, the polyunsaturated fat intake was also linked to a decreased risk of cardiovascular disease. And when the results were calculated, other important lifestyle factors were also taken into account. Quote, "The findings are clinically relevant and support current dietary guidelines that advise us to shift from saturated, that's your animal and dairy, to unsaturated fats." There is one exception, of course, and that is coconut. Coconut is one of nature's most perfect foods, most perfect waters in the coconut, one of the most perfect fats. So there you are, good fats, long life. This morning when I did my workout, I took my beet juice. I take beet juice, about 8 ounces, and 8 ounces of coconut water, and a blend of some powders that contain green and red to fully energize me and give me all the electrolytes because I'm working out in hot environment. And it was interesting because at the beginning of the week, and today's our final day of a health retreat for this one group. Wonderful group, by the way. Such positive, energetic people to be around. They came mainly from Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma. One woman came from South Africa. And interesting because she comes from a medical family. Her husband was an orthodox, highly respected, achieved medical doctor, and she's also in the medical field. And she has an irreversible condition, and she said that, you know, she could either stay at home and die in a very short period of time, or she could try something. And the good news is that she has seen improvement, and she's feeling great. So hopefully a week from now or even 2 weeks from now, I'll have her on the air and we'll see how she's doing, in her own words. But she's not able to go out and walk. But the others who start the beginning of the week, they did a good walk, and about on a hilly course, beautiful bucolic, horses and cows and sheep grazing. And she, these people would do about a 17-minute pace per mile. But today I asked them to do an energy workout, and it was all about energy. And they did 12-minute per mile, and two of them are over 65. As I commented to them, had you been in a race today, a state championship, you would have actually won. They had never raced, they had never power walked, but they felt great. And I thought that was good. Now, they didn't have the beet juice. I had the beet juice. And I always feel good when I'm working out. And one of the reasons is because, another is because you can use your workout in the morning if you're doing power walking to clear yourself of thoughts, be conscious the moment you're in, not to think about problems, just be present, mindful the moment you're in. And therefore, you can listen to the birds, you can feel the warm breezes, you can see everything around you when you are conscious in the moment. And it was just such a nice experience to see people be able to do something they had not done and realize what potential they have in them to get even healthier. And so it was one of those ooh-ah moments. And there have been many, a lot of them this week. I'll let them tell you in their own words. When they exit today, they're going to give some comments. Well, the beet juice, according to the Kyung-hee University in South Korea and published in the American Journal of Physiology, Regulatory, Integrative, and Complementary Physiology, is a major improvement to our workouts. Here's what it says in this particular study. It says that those who were in the study and who consumed the beet juice containing the nitrate had beneficial effects on the work of the heart in response to exercise, and because you're getting the nitric oxide, and that opens up your capillaries, allows more blood to flow through, greater oxygenation of your tissue, greater oxygenation of your heart and your brain. So when you do your workout, have about 8 ounces of beet juice and maybe 4 ounces of coconut water. It'll help you have a better quality exercise. From a major study reviewing from Harvard School of Public Health, reviewing meat and the color of meat. This is from London, quote, "Scientists believe they may have discovered why eating red meat is linked to higher chances of bowel cancer. The pigment that gives a steak its distinctive red color is to blame, they suggest. The part of the blood's hemoglobin that binds in oxygen to allow it to be transported around the body is found in much higher quantities in red meat than in white meat. It contains iron, which produces the red color. While red meat, which includes beef, lamb, pork, veal, venison, and goat, have been linked to cancer for several decades, the new understanding of the mechanism by which it causes cancerous cells to form is likely to help in prevention." And researchers at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands discovered the link between that blood chemical and bowel cancer by feeding red pigment to mice. And they found that the mice suffering damage to their gut lining. On closer inspection, they discovered that the bacteria in the gut was turning that pigment into hydrogen sulfide, which is the chemical which produces a smell like rotten eggs and damages the lining of the gut. To repair the damage, the cells rapidly regrow, but this rapid regrowth creates a greater chance of a cancerous tumor forming. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They also found that the adverse effects of eating meat were stopped when you kill this particular bacteria. The scientists suggest that the hydrogen trisulfide, a chemical produced by the gut bacteria, could be a useful chemical marker indicating who is at risk of bowel cancer. Now, I believe that they are partially correct, but here's what they're not telling you, and other research has confirmed. When you're eating any type of meat, you're not eating it raw. That would be deadly. There is a meat in Syria and Lebanon and other Middle Eastern countries. It's called kibbeh. And it's a raw meat where they take raw ground-up meat and then they put in some parsley, chopped up, some, let's say, a little piece of garlic, tiny pieces of onion, and sometimes some cayenne pepper. And then they mix that together and they roll it into a much like a sandwich and or a wrap sandwich. But it's extraordinarily dangerous because of all the potential for ringworm and other pathogens that are in the meat, E. coli especially. But when you cook meat, to kill these microorganisms that are pathogenic, you have to cook it at a high temperature. So when you're cooking at a high temperature, the chemicals in the meat, the bonds begin to cross-link. And the cross-linking of these bonds, much like, let's say, you put your two hands together where your fingers interlace with one another. Now turn one hand's finger straight up. Now you have a cross-linking. That's what happens with the protein. And then when that mixes with sugars in the body, you end up with prematurely aged cells. It's really dangerous. Now, that cooking process of meat creates heterocyclic amines, and the heterocyclic amines are known carcinogens. Also, anytime you have saturated fat from animal in the diet, the whole digestive process slows down so that bile from your gallbladder can be secreted through the bile duct and break down fat into smaller and smaller particles so it can be absorbed. But it also means that all the food in your intestine slows down. So visualize this. You're eating a plant-based meal. Let's say you have some brown rice and some beans and a salad and some starchy vegetables and seaweed. All right, normal digestion. But let's say you have a steak or a hot dog or a hamburger or pizza. You've got fat. Suddenly, you go from 60 miles an hour to 5. It's the big slowdown when you have meat. That means that the chemicals in the meat are able to stay in contact with the lining of the intestine longer, and that creates inflammation, and that can create polyps or can create cancer. So that's the other part of the equation. It's not just the bacteria that is affected, not just by the heme. So at least they gave you some new information, all the more why we should be concerned about the meat that we eat. Now, segueing from that, we're going to hear now, my engineer is going to, in New York, get ready to play a segment from a Dr. Melanie Joy. She is a Harvard psychologist, PhD, and that tells you why all animal proteins are dangerous to consume. And there's more. There are at least 45 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing why animal proteins are dangerous. But now let's broaden it back. Let's take a step back and ask ourselves, do we ever think about the source of our protein? Do we care where it comes from? Listen to what she has to say. I think you'll find this interesting.
Imagine you're a guest at a fancy dinner party. You're sitting down at a beautiful table, enjoying the conversation, drinking fine wine, and eating a delicious beef stew. In fact, the stew is so delicious that you ask the host for her recipe. And she says, flattered, "Well, the secret is in the meat. You use 3 pounds of well-marinated golden retriever." Now stop for a minute and think about your reaction to that. Dog? In America, we don't eat dogs. Dogs aren't for eating. So chances are your experience radically changed after hearing that line. Chances are what was once food to you, you now see as a dead animal. chances are what was once delicious just moments ago has become disgusting. Nothing about the meat itself actually changed. The texture is the same, the flavor is the same, the smell is the same, but your experience has dramatically altered. So what's going on here? Your reaction is an example of carnism. Carnism is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat some animals, but not others. Carnism is why we typically don't envision the animal when we sit down, for instance, to a plate of beef, chicken, or pork. It's also why we can't help but envision the animal when, for instance, we're served golden retriever, swan, or guinea pig. Carnism is the reason that we're typically disgusted by the idea of, out of tens of thousands of animal species, eating all but a tiny handful of them. And it's also the reason we don't stop to think about why this is the case. When meat eating isn't necessary for survival, it's a choice, and our choices always stem from our beliefs. But we don't see meat eating as we do vegetarianism, as a choice based on a set of assumptions about ourselves, our world, and animals. Rather, we see it as a given, as the natural thing to do, as just the way things are. We eat animals without thinking about what we're doing and why, because the belief system that underlies this behavior is invisible. This invisible belief system is what I call carnism. Why is it important to know about carnism? Because our choices matter. They matter to ourselves, they matter to animals, and they matter to the planet. When we eat meat, we have to disconnect psychologically and emotionally from the truth of our experience. We have to numb ourselves from the reality that we're eating a dead animal. Carnism blocks our awareness, and it blocks our empathy toward the animal that we're eating. And awareness and empathy are integral to our sense of self. So eating meat requires us to be mindless rather than mindful. It requires us to be apathetic rather than empathetic. And meat eating has been connected with the leading causes of disease in the Western world, while meat production is a primary cause of environmental devastation. And because our choices matter, it's essential that we understand where our choices come from. So when we understand that eating meat is the inevitable end result of a widespread, deeply entrenched, invisible belief system or ideology, this dramatically changes the way that we think about and talk about meat eating. Like many Americans, I grew up with a dog who I loved like a family member. And like many Americans, I grew up eating meat. And I never thought about how I could pet my dog while I ate my hamburger without recognizing the profound inconsistency in my attitude and behaviors toward animals. I always cared about animals, and yet I ate them, often several times a day. So I had this knowing without knowing. On one level, I was aware that animals had to suffer and die for my plate. Yet on another level, I preferred not to know. I preferred not to connect the dots. So I lived with this internal, moral, often unconscious discomfort. I had to maintain a gap in my consciousness when it came to eating meat. As a young adult, I learned a lot about meat production, and I came to realize that I was unable to maintain the psychic numbing necessary to continue eating animals. I experienced a profound paradigm shift, a shift of consciousness. What I had once seen as food, I now saw as a dead animal. While I had never questioned my food choices, I now came to become conscious of the decisions about what I ate. I wanted to understand what had happened to me and to other vegetarians to cause such a profound shift of consciousness. I wanted to understand how I had been able to spend my whole life as a person who truly cared about animals, to have eaten them, and to have never made the connection. I wanted to understand how humane people could participate in inhumane practices without even realizing what they're doing. I entered a doctoral program in psychology where I interviewed vegans, vegetarians, meat eaters, and meat cutters about their experience eating and/or working with meat. And across the board, without exception, every one of them told me that in order to either eat or process animals, they had to numb themselves. They had to disconnect from the reality that they were dealing with a dead animal. The vegans and vegetarians told me that when they had eaten meat, they had to numb themselves. And when they were no longer able to numb themselves, they were no longer able to eat meat. And this awareness gave birth to my understanding of the invisible system that I've come to call carnism. My hope is that by understanding the invisible system of carnism, people will be able to step outside of that system to make their choices more freely. Because without awareness, there is no free choice. Because in our culture, we've all been conditioned to see the world through the lens of carnism. We're all participants in the system, for better or worse. So our choice isn't whether we participate, but how we participate. With awareness, we can choose to be active witnesses rather than passive bystanders. We can choose to be informed consumers and empowered citizens. Ultimately, I hope that after reading my book, people will be able to live more authentic and freely chosen lives, acting in the best interest of themselves, animals, and the planet.
And that was a psychologist, Harvard, talking about her experience. It's wonderful when you can have a purely vegan meal, organic, with lots of raw living foods that is made to look like a piece of art and taste exquisite. So for people who are wondering, can you survive on a meatless diet? You bet. In fact, starting in another week, I'm going to be putting up a photograph and a recipe of original gourmet vegan meals, the type you would see in Gourmet Magazine or Epicure, all brand new. I just created 250 brand new ones and photographed them. These will be a gift, no charge. You can take it down and try it and see how wonderful it tastes. And this will hopefully motivate some of you to start leaning away from the meat and getting into veganism. I'm frequently asked, will I do a commentary or will I share insights or information for myself or others on important issues that motivate someone? For example, showing a young boy that has not just handcuffs, but his whole arms are handcuffed above the elbows, so he can't stand up. And he's a little kid, a little tiny boy, because he was disruptive in a class. And I'm thinking of how many schools now have police in the school where a young girl was, and she has a problem. She has narcolepsy. And she was in study hall, and she'd gone to sleep. And a police came in and just beat her to a pulp. She had committed no crime. But now we are arresting, we are harming young people because somehow they're not being completely obedient to an artificial standard. Hence, the idea that shouldn't we take a look? There was a Nobel Prize winner, Thiong'o, who said that children are the future of any society. If you want to maim the society, simply maim the children. If one important measure of a democracy is how a society treats its children, especially children of color, poor and working class youth, and those with disabilities, there can be little doubt that the United States is failing. Why? Half of all of our public school children live in poverty. Half. 16 million children receive food stamps, and 90% of black children will be on food stamps at some point in their childhood. 90%. Moreover, too many children are either incarcerated or homeless. The National Center on Family Homelessness reports that 1 in 45 children experience homelessness in America every year. That's over 1.6 million children will go to school and have no home to go to when they get out of school. Moreover, while homelessness, they experience high rates of acute and chronic health problems. The constant barrage of stressful and traumatic experience also has profound effects on their development and ability to learn. Sadly, these statistics rarely scratch the surface of the dire and deep-seated problems facing many young people in the richest country in the world, a state of affairs that provokes virtually no public outrage. Now, I've lived on the Upper West Side my entire adult life of Manhattan. I also have lived my entire adult life on a farm or a ranch, as I do now. So I have an ability to enjoy both the country and being close to nature and animals, and show a reverence for life and provide an environment for other people to do the same, which I enjoy sharing that gift. But also when you live in a city like New York, you also have a gift of some of the finest culture and some of the finest minds. But at the same time, you are always aware that no one moves to New York for their health. No one moves to New York to be relaxed and de-stressed. Now imagine then what it is for a child to be in that environment. And recently the New York Post had a front page story and then carried it forward as a call to action to rid the whole Upper West Side and the city of people who might, they had one man who would, they caught him urinating in the street. And suddenly that was a call to action to get rid of all these people. Well, I know that man, because it was outside of my building that he has lived for years. In fact, sleeping downstairs in the vestibule of my building. And so I've had a chance to speak with him. And it is not an easy conversation. There are people in the city who need to be in some compassion mental health care. And when the city does not have a place for them, then they're either on the street or they're in prison. What do you think it's like for a person suffering from mental problems to be in a prison and not understand the culture, the gangs, which they don't join, and the ability to communicate with others, which is rare and impossible for them? They're put in solitary confinement. They're beaten. They're tortured. They're killed. That's happened at Rikers Island. And it happens all the time. It's every single 24 hours. Yet when I go into the park in the morning to do my run, and I go early because I get up at 4, I frequently see long lines, I mean a long line, of men standing in silence, waiting to get to a water fountain where they take their shirt off and they'll wash their chest and under their arms and their face, and they'll brush their teeth and they'll shave, and then they dry themselves and they go about trying to find work. These are not people with mental problems. These are people with economic problems, with equality problems. Whenever I always take extra with me, money, when I go to the park, and I offer it, I say, can I help you? Sometimes they say no. Most often, they're grateful for it. Many of them don't even speak English. But whatever I have, if I can help them with a meal to make that day a little less of a stress, that's what I want to do. And yet there's a movement on the Upper West Side that people who go out jogging early don't want to see these people. You're in our neighborhood. You're an embarrassment. You make us feel uncomfortable. So I began to ask people, just regular people you see walking their dogs on the Upper West Side, what do you think about the homeless people up here? Oh, it's a crisis. They got to get rid of them. Now, the other day, while I was doing my jog, a man stopped me and said, hey, Gary, he wanted to ask me some questions. He said, I saw you move from your office. I said, yeah, after all those decades, had to move. And we had a conversation. It turns out this person has the most important position with a major cultural institution in New York City that everyone in the world knows. And I asked him, I said, you sit here every day. Do you ever see the homeless? Oh, yeah, all the time. What do you think? Well, they shouldn't be here. And I said, why? Why not? Where should they be? How should they get there? I said, in New York City, we have over 1 million square feet of empty office space that the government owns. Why shouldn't the government be applying some of that million square feet to make them into hospice care, home rental for or a space for people who have no money at all, and even holistic mental health counseling to help people who need mental health counseling? And he said, well, it's a good idea, but, you know, this is the Upper West Side. People don't care about other people. And I just stopped and I said, say it again. And he looked and there was no irony. He said, people care about themselves. If you're spending $4 million on an apartment, some of those people do, or $10 million, and this is a neighborhood and you got your kids, you care about that and their safety. You don't want. And I said, but these are human beings. How quickly we forget what happens when the economy changes against someone. So I said this, you realize that based upon what you just said, that we could have at least 10 million Americans who were millionaires, and many of them associated with the financial industry, who could also be homeless if we did not save them. We gave them $16 trillion in interest-free loans to save Goldman Sachs, Citibank, JP Morgan Chase. They would all been bankrupt, and the people invested in them bankrupt. We bailed them out. So it's okay to bail out people who live on the Upper West Side when they make million or even trillion-dollar errors. But a person who doesn't have a dollar, it's not okay to help them. And that was the end of the conversation. So think of the children who have no part in the conversation but are victims of it. Every age has its approach to identifying and handling problems. As we move into the second gilded age, young people are viewed more as a threat than as a social investment. Instead of being viewed as at risk in a society that has defaulted on its obligations to young people, youth today are viewed as the risk itself. Instead of recognizing the social problems and troubles they face, ranging from poverty to punishing schools, our society sees youth as spoiled or threatened. And one consequence is that their behaviors are increasingly criminalized in the streets, in the malls, the schools, and other places that once were considered safe spaces for them. As compassion and social responsibility give way to punishment and fear as the most important modalities mediating the relationship with youth to the larger social order, schools resort more and more to zero-tolerance policies and other punitive practices. Such practices often result in the handing over disciplinary problems to the police rather than to educational personnel or human resources. With the growing presence of police and surveillance technologies and security guards in schools and more of what kids do, how they act, how they dress, and what they say are defined as criminal offense, regardless of how trivial, meaningless the offense may be. In some cases, just doodling is enough to get you arrested. Violating a dress code could get you arrested. Such behaviors, which teachers and administrators used to regulate through everyday means, are now treated as infractions within the purview of the police. Consequently, suspensions, expulsions, arrests, and jail time have become just normal everyday routine, but only for poor youth of color. Even more shocking is the rise of zero-tolerance policies to punish black students and students with disabilities. Instead of recognizing the need to provide services for students with special needs, there's a dangerous trend on the part of school systems to adopt policies that end in seclusion, restraint, expulsion, and too often law enforcement intervention for the disabled children involved. Sadly, this is but a small sampling of the way in which children are being punished instead of educated in the United States schools, and especially inner-city schools. Rather than treating school infractions as part of the professional responsibilities of teachers and administrators, schools are criminalizing such behavior and calling the police. What might have become a teachable moment becomes a criminal offense. Since the 1990s, the U.S. public has been swamped by the fear of an alleged rise in teenage crime and what was called a super predator crisis. This crisis was largely popularized by a political scientist at Princeton University who argued with irony that, quote, what did he say, the hordes of depraved teenagers about to be using unspeakable brutality but tethered by conscience, not. Politicians and intellectuals, news organizations were convinced that young people posed a dire threat to the U.S. public and not only reveled on these sensational predictions, but ran with them like a punt returner finding daylight. And while such chaos proved to be nonsense, because the vast majority of students are not lawless, the thesis spawned a plethora of disciplinary practices in schools, such as zero-tolerance policies, which have turned them into institutions that resemble prisons, with students being subjected to harsh disciplinary practices, particularly black, poor children, and children suffering from mental health problems. And these harsh practices have been inflicted disproportionately on black children and children suffering from mental health problems, such as any child suffering from ADHD. This was on full display as social media lit up with a video that disclosed an 8-year-old boy in the third grade in an elementary school classroom in Covington, Kentucky, screaming in pain because he was being handcuffed with his arms placed behind his back. Standing beside the child was a police officer, Deputy Sheriff Kevin Summer, who issued this message: "You either behave the way you're supposed to, or you suffer the consequences." The child, it was later revealed, suffered from learning disabilities. And unfortunately, that person, the sheriff's deputy, is protected. While the image of an 8-year-old boy handcuffed in an elementary school classroom in Covington, Kentucky, has rightfully drawn a great deal of attention on social media and in the mainstream news, it is far from unique. In 2013, a diabetic student in an Alabama high school was arrested and beaten for falling asleep in a classroom. In 2013, Bronx police falsely accused a 7-year-old boy and put him in handcuffs and held him in custody for 10 hours. A 7-year-old boy. Gee whiz. Must be really tough. I'm surprised they didn't shoot him. After all, in New York, it's very easy to say, "I felt threatened." 5 police, guns drawn, felt threatened by an unarmed 7-year-old boy. Wow. Why am I not surprised? It's all politics. U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit November 12th charging that the Meridian, Mississippi school district functioned largely as a school-to-prison pipeline, disproportionately focusing on black youth. According to the Justice Department's 37-page complaint, the Meridian School District engaged in years of systemic abuse, which punished youth so arbitrarily and severely as to shock the conscious. And yet, these occur every single day in the United States. In conclusion, the increasing criminalization of students of color, poor students, and students with disabilities is taking place in the context of a broader attack on public schools as a whole. Like many institutions that represent the public good, public schools are under attack by market, religious, and educational fundamentalists. Schools are considered dangerous because they are public, not because they are failing. State and corporate leaders are seeking to take power out of the hands of public school teachers and administrators because public schools harbor teachers with the potential to engage in the different imaginative, empowering, critical, and capable of connecting learning with the practice of freedom and the search for justice, something that clearly is a threat. Well, students are not criminals. There are no safe spaces left in the United States for our children. As almost every aspect of society becomes militarized, the imposing apparatuses of the police state become more and more obvious, regardless of the reckless and dangerous manner in which local police forces look at you. Schools are not prisons, teachers are not a security detail, and students are not criminals. Schools should be models for the investment in children, their minds, their capabilities, their interests, their curiosities. If public schools are going to improve, they have to be appropriately funded. That means raising corporate taxes, cutting the defense budget, and allocating funds that contribute to the school and the public good. Will you find mean-spirited bullies? Will you find people out of control in different schools? Yes. Will you see them with the viral videos of beating each other to a pulp, hitting teachers? Yes, those are real. Do they represent a clear and present threat to the schools, the teachers, and the students? No. And these should be dealt with by the schools, not by the police. And that does not mean that every student then is a potential threat to our system. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us.
To love you, didn't you know it, babe? Didn't you know it? Why couldn't you be content with the love I gave? Oh, yeah, I gave you my heart, but you wanted my mind. Oh, yeah, you're alive. Scared me to death, girl. All it's a choking kind. That's all it is. You can kill a man.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's now go over and say hello to John Michael Greer, one of America's most insightful historical philosophers, a futurist and an independent scholar, environmentalist, and expert in energy and peak oil studies, and the author of some important and futuristic work, including After Progress, Reason and Religion at the End of the Industrial Age. And his website is the archdruidreport.blogspot.com. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on.
There have been many in the past who have observed how fervent belief in science and technology contains the characteristics of religion, even atheistic scientific belief. Bertrand Russell warned of this. I think we can readily observe this trend in medical science today, which has become increasingly reductionistic, determinist, and refused to accept any speculative insight that challenges its materialistic view that we can only be measured and witnessed either with our gross senses or by technological means. But it's also found in the high-tech religion of singularity and those who believe immortality can be reached by interfacing humans with computer advancements. But we don't often hear of economics and approaching this discipline with a religious faith, particularly free market capitalist economics, which is driven by a blind belief in infinite progress and the idea that if a solution to a problem doesn't exist in this moment, not a problem, we'll invent a solution. And you have noted some of the shared characteristics the religion of progress shares with theistic or theological traditions. And this was certainly clear with the Republican debates, and it's endemic to the Democratic candidates as well. So please begin with an overview of the myth of progress that dominates our current corporate economy today as being kind of a religion. And then how does this belief keep its followers in denial about this myth's limitations and self-destructive nature? The forum is yours.
Okay. Yeah, basically, the thing is that the religion of progress is not just kind of sort of like a religion. It serves all the same functions that a religion does. It's the way we think about the future. It's the source, for most people, it's the source of hope. You know, where medieval peasants believed in the wonder-working powers of the bones of St. Ethelfrith or whoever, people nowadays place all their faith on, you know, they'll think of something. Progress will fix that. That's our utopia. That's our heaven. That's the thing that makes most people convinced that there's some better world in the future. And it's a mythology. Okay? It so happens that for the last couple of hundred years, we've had a remarkable run, which has mostly been caused by the reckless extraction and exploitation of the world of the Earth's supply of fossil fuels. But we've mapped that back onto all of history. We've mapped that forward into infinity. It's amazing how many people literally can't think about the world without thinking that it's on this automatic escalator that starts from the caves and goes to the stars. How does it function as a religion? First of all, of course, it's the explanation for why things are the way they are. Why are we here in the United States, the 5% of us in the world, getting about a third of the world's natural resources, about a quarter of its energy supplies, and so on? Well, that's because we're more progressive, okay? Why didn't other people in the past have the same values that we do? Why do people in other cultures have different values? Well, that's because we're progressed, we're right, they're wrong, and so on and so forth. It's exactly the same kind of fundamentalist thinking that you'll find, you know, in the sort of hardcore evangelical types in any religion. You know, we have the truth, everyone else is wrong, and everyone else will either, you know, march on, join us on our march onward to the stars, or descend into the, you know, the eternal damnation of poverty and what have you like that. So it's basically, this is something that happens in the lifespan of every civilization. You get a set of supposedly secular ideas that are modeled on the previous religion of that society, in our case modeled on Christianity, and so on. It has all the same ideas, but it just ditches God, it ditches anything allegedly supernatural, but it takes all the same emotions, it takes all the same content, all the same concepts, and applies that to some set of secular ideas. This is the truth, this is the gospel, now, you know, we're going to go to heaven. You mentioned the singularitarians, okay? The singularity is the rapture in science fiction drag. Okay, in place of Jesus, you have super intelligent computers. In place of the glorified bodies elect, you have the robot bodies we're all going to be uploading our consciousness into. Instead of heaven, you have outer space. It's all the same rap. You just switch things over into, as I say, science fiction drag, and you've got the same emotions, the same commitment, the same constant willingness to pretend that the same thing hasn't been predicted over and over and over again, so we can put our faith that this Thursday Jesus or the super intelligent computer replacing him is going to show up. And that's the way that the whole myth of progress operates. It's all the basic concepts of evangelical Christianity translated over into a kind of technodrag, and people take it on faith. They take on our absolute blind faith. Most Americans suggest to them that progress is not guaranteed, that it was a temporary condition caused by certain environmental factors, such as the fact that there was a lot of loose carbon underground that we could steal and burn, and that it's going to, that it will, in fact, that it's already slowing to a crawl, and that in many ways the peak of innovation actually happened more than a century ago. You tell them that, even if you could document it, they look at you as though, again, like a medieval peasant who just looked up into the sky and found that God and his saints weren't in heaven anymore. It's really quite striking.
I appreciate the insight. How has our Judeo-Christian-based culture fueled the religion of progress and civil religion and the religion of science, and even the increase in atheism that is being witnessed today?
Well, now there are two questions there, because on the one hand, you've got the feed-in from the Judeo-Christian religion, or specifically Christianity. I mean, the Jews, frankly, get a bad rap here. But the transition from Christian religion to the religion of progress and the way that it drives atheism are actually two different factors. On the one hand, you've got, with the decline of Christian faith, you've got a lot of people who no longer believe in the gospel of Jesus, but who still have the same emotional needs that it used to meet. So they start looking for another savior. And our society, our media, are very, very eager to push saviors on them. But the primary savior that a lot of people have fallen for, of course, is technology. They haven't yet nailed technology to a cross, but I'm sure that's going to come along in due time. The force that's driving the rise in atheism nowadays comes out of monotheism, out of Christian monotheism, by another route. All of the arguments that Christianity used against other religions with more than one God back in the day, or in fact quite recently, are all basically ways of saying, well, that's God, that God's not real, that God's not real, that God's not real, we've got the only real God, okay? That's your basic monotheist thing. The problem is, when you've already disbelieved in all the other gods, what's one more? So, you know, when you winnow down the field to one, the atheists simply take the usual Christian arguments against all the other gods, point to the Christian god, say, that god's not real either. So it's just sort of a natural progression. You go from polytheism to monotheism to atheism in a pretty straight line.
Also, we can say that our current economic capitalist model is following that same route. We only believe in one economic system, and when it's failed to address the needs of everyone, then we begin to lose trust in it, but we don't have the courage to abandon it unless we have something to take its place. And the corporate culture, the media, doesn't allow alternative views to be shared.
That's a very important point, because capitalist economics has become another faith-based system. If it causes untold human suffering, well, that's the creative destruction of capitalism. We don't talk about the fact that all the creation goes into one set of pockets and all the destruction lands on everyone else. Modern economics, generally speaking, is a complete mess, and it's largely a mess because it's incorporated a range of faith-based ideas borrowed third-hand from religion. There's a running joke that you've probably heard. What do you call an economist who makes a prediction? The answer is wrong. And the reason that joke is widespread, the reason that so many economists make so many wrong predictions and nobody calls them on it, is precisely that the entire science of economics, pseudoscience of economics, frankly, is grounded on a set of assumptions about human nature, about the world, and so on, that are garbage. You have economists who will say with a straight face that if you have enough capital, there's an infinite amount of oil in the planet. This is simply nuts. I mean, I'm sure all of our listeners have seen a picture of the Earth from space. I'm sure none of them have seen a pipeline from Neptune, this replenishing the oil we're using up. The Earth is a sphere. It's not flat. There's a finite amount of oil in it. When the oil is used up, it's gone. It doesn't matter how much capital you have. But you have economists.
That's also true for the forests.
Yeah. You have economists.
Our entire economic model.
Yeah.
Our entire economic world model, at least in the United States and Europe, and the European Union is a larger economy than the United States and more people, we have the model that we have unlimited resources to build unlimited homes, factories, high-rise cars, televisions, whatever it is. No matter how big the population, we will always be able to supply them with a standard of living because someone can control it and profit from it, and no one's asking the basic question, shouldn't we be looking at a different economic and social model and start to re-educate people on the idea that we're running out of everything?
Thank you. Yes, exactly. And the basic economic model we have is a flat Earth model. It's as though these people do not know the world is round. If the Earth were flat, there'd be an infinite amount of Earth underneath it, presumably. Or either that, or you go down until you hit the first elephant or something. But literally, it's crazy. And yet, this is glued into the orthodoxy of our time. And again, I think it's reasonable to talk about it as a religion. Why do we believe this? Well, because we've been promised by the gospel of progress that we're going to the stars. We can't get to the stars unless we have infinite economic resources. Therefore, we must have infinite economic resources. By any other standard, by any reasonable standard, that's insane. But that's the logic on which our society runs its affairs these days. And that's just plain nuts.
One final comment, please. I'd like you to speak on the failures of the green capitalism and our blind understanding that it is not how we derive energy, whether from fossil fuels or renewable, but that how the energy is used is equally important.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could talk about the failures of green capitalism for a very long time. To begin with, of course, the entire confusion here that capitalism requires growth. Anything green requires stability, requires a zero-sum situation. We have to live within our means. Those two are not compatible. How we use our energy matters. Where the energy is coming from, well, it's great if it's a solar panel. What's building the solar panel? What are all the inputs? There's no whole systems thinking. And that's the thing that has to happen. This isn't capitalism is incapable of course. But that's the thing. You have to look at where the energy is going, what it's doing, what impacts it's having upon the whole system of the biosphere. You have to look at every step of the way, or you're going to get whacked to the behind by something you didn't see coming. And that's basically where we are right now.
Well, you have certainly laid this out in your newest book, and I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to an hour conversation on our Conversations with Remarkable Minds, our commentary hour, where we can explore this in greater detail. But you've whetted the appetite for more.
Thank you.
John Michael Greer, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Michael's latest book is After Progress, Reason and Religion at the End of the Industrial Age. The website is the archdruidreport.blogspot.com. Have a nice day, everyone. Mm-hmm.